5 volt. The resistor was a 20K, about 10 watts. Now, if you're going to have, if you can't get a resistor like that, a wire wound resistor like that, if it's not available, you'll have to make it out of discrete resistors. Now you're going to have to figure out how much these resistors that you're going to put in, let me let it drop. You'll have to do it if you have to, you can't get a resistor. Most likely you can still get a wire wound tap resistor like that from one of those surplus places. However, if you can't, what you got to do now, do some homework and figure out. I gave you the parameters. I'll tell you approximately how much current. If you can get it, you'll let me know. I'll tell you approximately how much current each one of the taps, the voltage and the current that it'll carry. And then you'll have to do some study and understand how to determine from that point on what the resistors. They're going to be a bunch of series resistors now. And they're going to, where the resistors connect together, are going to be different values, the resistors, and they're going to form you the same way a tap resistor, except now you won't have the availability of making the adjustments in each tap. These are going to be now fixed resistors. So we'll leave it at that, said Gilbert.
Yeah, those wire wound resistors from surplus sales in Nebraska.
The brand name of the radio got covered up by the announcement, Mel. Tell us the brand name again, because Rich may recognize it, and he might have the schematic. Over to you, Mel.
Schematic's no problem yet, but they don't give you a lot of values. What they did on this thing, they told you, you know what it was? I remember that. They gave you the resistor and had the taps already set up for it. It came already set up. In other words, this was a kit stick put out by a company called Bullers Electronics. They put out a six-tube receiver that went from 160, from broadcast band to 30 megs, over.
Wonder if he might, if there's a chance, it's an oddball, but he might look on the internet for W7 Foxtrot Golf manuals. He's got tons and tons of reprints that he makes up. W7 FG manuals.
Yeah, the manual is, he's got the schematic, but it does not give you a value of that resistor. It came, the resistor, they just told you how to mount it up onto the chassis, and the taps were already set up. They gave you no value of the resistor itself on the parts list or the schematic, over.
Okay, I understand now. That means you're going to have to do what you said. But the wire wound resistors, once he knows what he needs, I know that surplus sales of Nebraska has tons and tons of wire wound resistors, all different values, all different wattages. That's probably the best place to get it, surplus sales of Nebraska.
Where he's already got the schematic, and the kit didn't tell you, that's quite a bit of missing information. One other thing to worry about, Mel, is there's a reason that original resistor burned up. There's a shorted bypass capacitor or a gassy tube somewhere. You and I, or Rich, would like to fix a radio like this because of the nostalgia. We like a particular brand name. We consider it a challenge. The particular person you're talking to, unless he's very restricted on funds, is going to have to admit the fact that this particular radio kit sounds to me like it might be 1970 vintage. That makes it 39 years old, and maybe for a smaller number of dollars than repairing this one, he can buy something more modern, particularly on the surplus market or at a good flea market. So as a beginning person, it's good education to fix a thing like this, but in the beginning, you need an awful lot of equipment to have a good transmitter, a good receiver, and a good antenna. And for you and I to fiddle with a thing like this, because our station is all established, we're doing it for the fun reason. We're not doing it for economics. But as a new person who wants to establish so many pieces of equipment at first to get on the air before he loses the enthusiasm, is it cost-effective to fix something this old, this troubled, as opposed to getting something slightly newer but used. That's a question that should be asked once in a while. K2KE1, K2RIW.
Okay, I get quite a letter from him, and he's a young person and doesn't have very much in financial backing. And so he would like to start out, he'd like to listen, you know, to CW and all. And it would be basically a simple start. He basically said it was working, the radio. It was it has no cabinet. The cabinet was optional and all. And the person that was giving it to him, it was working, it basically fell over, breaking the resistor and just stuck up above the chassis, doing no other damage than smashing the resistor up. That's the crux of it. In other words, he feels that if he just replaces this resistor, that this radio will work, Dick, over.
Okay, you said some magic words there. That radio, that original tapped wire-wound resistor, is a piece of porcelain with a bunch of wires. Most likely when it broke, when the radio fell and it got hit, the porcelain is broken, but the wire is still there. It would be possible to solder it back together, mechanically supported by something else. As crazy as it sounds, there's a slim chance, Mel, that wire-wound resistor itself can be repaired, soldered back together, so to speak. Back to you, Mel.
What about him taking a probe from a PTVM, measuring the broken pieces, adding it up, and he'd come up with the value he needs for each tap?
From what I understand, it was completely destroyed. The person picked it up and then handled it and tore the wire apart and all that kind of stuff. I asked him, I said, is there anything left that can be used, you know, to measure with? And he says, no, really, it was just sort of chucked out, you know, because it was a mess. So he's without that resistor, and that's the crux of it. What is the value? So I know from that radio design of that time what was necessary. So if you get that 20K, get a 20,000 ohm 10 watt resistor with the wire wound, as Rich just mentioned, from Surplus of Nebraska. If they have such a thing, they may even have the original, for all I know, because that was an off-the-shelf piece of a device that was very I guess it's as common as anything, you know, say, wire-wound resistors of that type. They were used in everything. Radio receivers, television receivers, everything you can think of. Many of them had this resistor, as Dick says, that was a combination of a bleeder and also of a tap resistance to provide several different voltage caps for the radio. So if you can get that, I could say... and set it up the way I did, I will more than glad to assist you a little further on it, but this is where you got to start out. See if you can get that resistor. 20K, 20,000 ohm, 10 watt resistor, wire wound, I think will begin to get you into the back, getting this radio back working, being that you said nothing else was wrong with it until it was inadvertently dropped over.
Oh, one other thing to worry about, Mel, when you buy a wire-wound resistor with a tap on it, there's almost always only one single tap. Sounds like two or three are required, so there's a little bit more consideration there required to make sure you've got enough of these taps on the resistor you buy in order to serve this function. Back to you, Mel.
We are.
Pick up 1 second. Yeah, well, you just request how many, you know, they sell the taps separate. The resistor does not come with the taps. The taps were packed separate, even way back when you bought them, in the, you know, back in the good old days, you bought the taps separate because a lot of times you didn't use the tap at all. So IRC was a big manufacturer of them, of course, you know, and you purchased extra taps if you wanted. Or I don't know, maybe they had, maybe it was even separately sold, the taps. Go ahead, Rich.
Suggestion, when I was younger, I made my own taps. What I used to do was go to a store that sold copper roofing tin, and it's thin enough. I was like 19 years old when I did this, maybe younger. You can actually cut copper tin, you know, thin copper strips with scissors. You don't even need a shear to do it. I would wrap it around the resistor to form the semicircle. Then I would take the tap and I would take a nail or a screw, make a little dimple in it where the dimple would ride on the wire wound part of the resistor, and have my tap.
Crafty. Well, that's it. So if you can get the resistor, Chuck, if you can get the resistor, the 20K wire wound 10 watt resistor, request that you leave three taps if they have them. I'm sure they're going to have all that stuff. That stuff was made by, literally by, as they say, the tons, or as they say, used to say, the schmooze. They just kept coming, whatever they call those little creepy characters. They just kept coming. And it's most likely available. And when you get it, if you have any questions, again, if you put it in and all, be careful. 300 volts is 300 volts, and it can give you a little bit of a, as we say, a zest, you know. So I encourage you, go ahead, and if you want, I'll tell you how. As Dick says, there are, look in the book, you'll, under Ohm's, Ohm's lore and all, start out with George Ohm, read the book, how to determine resistance values, when the, you know the voltage, you know the current, what's the resistance value, and so on and so forth. It'll lead you into other interesting things. Take, combine that, and Dick, as Dick said, things like Kirchhoff's law, Theravin, Norton, we work with that. Here's a good way to start into what you would like to study, electronics. I encourage you, see what you can do. You may find yourself into a fascinating field. Back to you, Dick.
Comment. Go right ahead. Is that, sounds like Alex.
No, and to explain, two half of the wattage resistors with twice of the resistance in parallel. Sometimes it's much easier to find. Over.
Yeah, when it comes to this resistor, you're recommending 20K, 10 watts. If he runs into a resistor that's not too expensive, and it's 20K and 20 watts, as long as it can physically fit into the structure, that's an easier way to go. Westlaw is telling us that you can also put resistors in parallel. If he can't get a 20K, but he can only get a 40K, he can put a pair of them in parallel. Got to be a little bit careful in how you adjust the taps between a pair, but series, parallel, combinations, there's lots of different ways of reconstructing that resistor. There's not just one. The resistor he puts in doesn't have to physically look identical to the old one, as long as it serves the same function. So series and parallel combinations of resistors of even bigger wattage should do the job very nicely. K2RIW.
Minimum of 10 watts. I know the resistor. I can picture it with the screw up the middle of the stick made out of ceramic, that sort of dark gray sort of ceramic kind of. It was a very popular resistor. Had the one side exposed. Everything else was covered with ceramic. Had the one side exposed where you slid the tap along. So it was a very, very common resistor. 20K, I know that approximate value for sure. I can almost tell you verbatim, you know, what the taps almost were, because, like I say, I sure did a lot of that building and fooling with that stuff in my time. So I just encouraging him. He wrote me a nice letter, you know, basically about his interest in, got very fascinated by electrical phenomena, and maybe he'd like to pursue, you know, going into the field and everything. And I sort of said to him, I, you know, wrote back a few things, and I said I'd bring it up on the TechNet to show that maybe we can encourage young people to study It takes study of mathematics. It does require you to figure this out originally, what the values were and all. It was a necessity to know math and a certain number of laws that are involved in designing this piece of equipment and coming up with these values and all. And so, basic Ohm's law, DC circuits and everything, a good place to start. I think that's the best way to start teaching this type of technology, Dick, over.
Yes, it is. And it can be very educational. And once you learn these rules, you'll use them for the rest of your life of electrical engineering. And going from DC to AC is not too big a jump. And going from AC to RF is not too big a jump. Step by step, it can be done. Okay, what's the next one, Mel? Go ahead.
I have a question if I'm not off topic.
Go right ahead. I'm pronouncing your name Westlaw. You can correct me, Mr. Olnick.
Thank you very much. November 2, X-ray, Juliet, November. I'm Wesley, W-E-S-L-E-Y. When I've got my first American license, which many years I've got the European one, that was 1974. In 1992, I believe, I've got, and I was still Westlaw. When I've got naturalized, and I became citizen of this great country, which proud of it, really proud of it, I became Wesley, W-E-S-L-E-Y. Well, my question is, I have two TS 2000. One is version, which is the mobile one, faceless, and the other one is a regular. Now, this one that I want to put to my car is the version. There are a number of screwdriver antennas, and I would like to hear your comments in terms of compromise. All of them are compromise. It's a high gain, we have a high gain, we have my telephone, we have a Scorpion, we have a high Tierra, and so many others. And then my question is, which one fights with a compromise based on your personal opinion the best way? Back to you guys.
Mel just got through saying that we're not very good at selecting brand names. However, the word high gain, at first when you said it, I thought you were talking about the performance of the antenna. Then I realized you're talking about a brand name. Every one of these small monopole-like antennas with a variable tuning device, screwdriver-like is what I think you're talking about, is a inductively loaded monopole. And it is my guess that as long as each one of them can be made to tune to resonance at your favorite frequency, and as long as each one has a matching network that will allow you to get a reasonable standing wave ratio at each of your favorite frequencies, there can't be a great deal of performance difference between the brand names. Mel's going to give you a lot more information because the Kings County Radio Club has for years held what they call a shootout, in which guys with their mobile antennas get into a great big parking lot like Floyd Bennett Field, and they actually go out and measure how much radio strength of the signal comes out of the car. But I think most of the brand names, when you hit resonance with good impedance match, are going to give performance fairly similar. But maybe your shootouts have shown that one brand is a hell of a lot better than the other or easier to use. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
For a moment, Wesley. No. I was trying to avoid the brand name issue because I've heard exactly the comment. What I was trying to ask for is which one of the principal designs fight the best way with the most rigid and economical way with the tuning problem. Some of them become higher because of the motor and the tuning, but the coil and the mechanism inside that is actually tuning through the coil like old amplifiers and P filters. And my question was actually in regards to the technical issues, not really to the brand name, because I heard the message November to X-ray to lead November.
Okay, good that you cleared that up. So, of the methods of operation is what I think he's really asking about, Mel. You probably know which method of operation is the best compromise. And some of them, I think he pronounced it P network, and I think he really means Pi network for impedance matching. Some of them have K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, you know, again, going out on a limb. The only thing I've ever been able to do, I've had a number of friends that have had mobile antennas. So what we did is basically we tried to do, you know, A-B comparisons and all over a period of time and see which antenna performs better on the mobile. And you know, how scientific this is to some extent. I mean, we didn't go down range and everything and set up, you know, good system, good interferometry or anything of that sort. It was just make a contact and say, well, hold on, let me try. I'm going to put another antenna on and see, tell me is this one, you know, is, what's this? A lot of them, it was so hard to, you know, determine exactly, you know, a real scientific, you know, definitely come up with a good scientific answer each time, you know, so it's only subjective. So what I did is I just measured in my mobile, my experiences with number of antennas, I tried ones that are base loaded, center loaded, top loaded, things like the top loaded grip for some reason on a mobile because maybe of the coil being moved further away from the body of the car, seems to perform somewhat better, Dick, over.
Okay, that's only part of what Wesley is asking, though. He really wants to know more about mechanical and impedance matching compromising. In other words, which one's easier to use, which one's stronger, which one takes up more altitude, it's going to be hitting the garage door. Are there other physical characteristics and methods of impedance matching that will make one easier to use, easier to live with than the other? Which technique of screwdriver-like antenna do you like the most as a as an overall compromise is what I think Wesley is asking. Back to you, Mel.
The one I'm using is not a screwdriver antenna. It's well made as far as being sturdy. Easily, depends on, you know, if you're going to operate mobile in motion, this one is ideal for that situation. It's made by Neutronics called the Hutflow Whip, and it's a solid pipe. It does take a bit of good solid, you know, good, you need a good sturdy bracket first to anchor it to the mobile, which is something not easily to come up with today. I've got really actually in my car, I got actually, you know, a good old spring, one of old mobile type springs, which I think may be a problem to install on a modern or, you know, a newer automobile. There is a number of these antennas now on the market, such as these screwdriver antennas and all. The problem with the one I have is if you want to change bands, you literally got to take the antenna, hold it down, and unscrew the coil and put another coil on. It's a single band operation. Is that responsible for better performance? I don't really know what to say in that factor. You want something that they have a number of these antennas now that you can remotely control the different bands on it. You don't have to go out and use the screwdriver on, Dick, over.
And those are the screwdriver so-called type of antennas, where there really is a screwdriver motor, a battery-operated motor, which you're remotely controlling, and it moves a coil, a tap point on a coil, up or down from the dashboard of the car. You can tell it, I used to be on 80 meters, now I move the tap so that it's operational on 40 meters. And Have your guys used those kind of screwdriver antennas, remotely controlled? Were they happy with them? I know there are some people out there who just love the screwdriver concept for a remotely tunable mobile antenna. Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Definitely. There are people that are very happy with that type of antenna setup and said they've had a lot of success with it, so I just leave it at that. I never like to rain on anyone's parade, as they say. As far as I'm concerned, if you want to know which one I was most impressed and still use, which I've had for many years, is the Neutronics Hustler Whip. Maybe in the last few years they have come up with some newer mobile whip antennas, because let's face it, they're constantly coming out with them. It would not surprise me if there is some new antenna, maybe that I haven't looked into, because this is all now a few years back, that possibly would perform as well or even better on a mobile dick and has the capability of being able to remotely change bands over.
Okay, you're happy with folding the antenna down, changing the coil, and then folding it back up as a method of changing bands. So if a person's willing to do that, he's got a much simpler design that doesn't have the elaborate motor, the remote control wiring, and the possible failure modes and water that can get in there, whatever. And is it sufficiently waterproofed? You've got a simpler, lower profile, higher reliability antenna in your Neutronics Hustler. To your knowledge, is Neutronics Hustler, and I've seen it on your car, by my standards, a fairly attractive looking thing. Is it still manufactured? Roughly how many dollars? Over to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Sure, if they're available, still the customers, they're still selling them. I would not know off the top of my head how much they are. They sell you basically the rod, you know, pole, and as I say, they have a lot of different things, you know, coils. You can buy coils for all different bands, and you just turn it down, screw it on. They got another gadget that's spring that goes up towards the top in case you go over a low object there so you don't break the coil off. They have a spring there. You know, you have the different mountings. They have several mountings, ball mounts, spring mounts, you know, tilt-overs. You name it, you know. If you look in the catalog any one of the companies that sell amateur radio equipment, I'm sure handle the Hustler brand. If you look at it, you'll see several different versions of the rod that goes up where it folds. They have them folding in the center. They have one that folds on the bottom. I mean, it's a whole selection. They got a lot of different antennas. They specialize mostly in mobile and vertical antennas, Dick. Over.
And for a moment. That antenna, I was using this antenna in 90s. One of the problems that I had with this antenna was that it was a pretty heavy stuff, especially when you put this coil. It was a huge one. And it put coils on that antenna, it clicked a tree. And it was swinging on that spring. I was much younger at that time. And I remember it was bouncing so much that the people behind me were keeping distance. Right now we have a new era. And for something like that, I would have a huge ticket. And another problem, the coils were center-tuned. That means it could actually extend that rod inside and have different frequency within the same band, but once you had it, you moved to the top or the bottom of the band, and then you didn't have so great SWR, or the coil required re-speak. That's the problem that I had with it. Otherwise, it was great antenna. Back to N2XJM.
Actually, you should turn down your audio. Your audio is about 5 decibels too loud. Your deviation is going beyond the edges of the receiver in the repeater. I've been listening to you on the input and the output, and now I know why. As you talk, the repeater is dropping out, and it drops out 5 or 10 times on each individual sentence as you hit the peaks of audio, so a little less audio is required on that particular rig. But the getting to Wesley's question, the bending of the antenna in the wind with the great big spring and scaring the people in the automobiles behind you is certainly something to worry about. As you can tell, Wesley, I'm a microwave person. I do very little HF operation. Mel does a lot of HF operation, and he's the former president of the Kings County Radio Club, and a good number of those members are HF operators. So he probably has some solutions on, an insulating string can be put on the antenna so that it's tied to the other corner of the car so it doesn't swing so much on the spring. I've seen people do that. It's a brute force approach. So methods of stopping it from swinging too much, you probably have some opinions on that one, Mel, particularly if you choose an antenna that's not so massive. And your Neutronics Hustler, I'm guessing you bought it 10 or 15 years ago. Was it approximately a $150 antenna at that time? Because I could make a rough estimate of the rate of inflation and make a guess as to what it's going to cost today, even before I go to the catalog. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, no, I've got a lot longer than that, Dick. This is K2KEY, 25 years at least, maybe more. I've had this on a couple of different mobiles. This one here is mounted up, you saw up in the top deck in the back there. And, of course, you can do that with cars like I'm running. That's my, you know, my own toy car, my Super Sport, Chevy Super Sport. I have inside the upper deck there, I forged, had a plate. I have a quarter-inch steel plate that's about 2 foot long and about 8 inches wide that was bent exactly to conform to the shape of that upper deck. And the whip is mounted, bolted to that. It sits inside the trunk. So to reinforce that area, to hold that whip up there with that spring, and I've traveled with it 65 miles an hour at least, or maybe I won't admit to faster, but you can read between the lines. And I've never had any problems with whipping around. I've got the heavy-duty spring on it and all. And did a lot of mobiling. Lots of it for a while there. That's basically all my amateur radio operating was mobiling. I was running around, going back and forth to the working QTH every day, and so that thing kept me company going and coming and riding along the parkway both ways. I had a grand old time of working everything, over 100 countries, and, WAS and everything. I had all kinds of contacts to those days, mobiling. Phenomenal. Had a lot of fun with it, Dick. So I've had no really problem of all the years operating with that mobile whip on the car, Dick. Over.
So I guess it's kind of hard to know of the modern equipment you can buy which ones have a lot of wind load and inadequate springs that they're going to bend too much. And you and I have seen people put a string on the antenna, a piece of nylon cord or whatever, to stop it from swinging in the breeze. But that's a slightly homely-looking approach, and it's kind of a brute force way of solving it. If Wesley did run into a problem of the antenna springing back too much in the wind and scaring people, I guess it's possible to buy a stronger spring, put another spring in parallel, buy another brand of antenna. When you're looking at the spec sheets, I'd like to believe the modern antennas don't have this excessive swinging problem at a 65 mile an hour wind. I'd like to believe that what Wesley ran into was a unique situation and not many of the modern antennas that he can buy are going to do that. Would I be somewhat safe in making that guess, Mel? KQRIW? Bernie, go ahead, Bernie, and then pass it over to Mel. You got it, Bernie.
Quick suggestion
for us. That was extremely noisy. I think you were saying Kilo Zero Bravo George. WWW Kilo Zero Bravo George. And I think you're saying that website has some of the information Wesley is looking for. Is that what you just said, Bernie? Go ahead.
Yes, affirmative. Sorry about the signal. I'm trapped in the server room right now.
Okay, so WWW Kilo Zero Bravo George. We'll give him some information. And I'd like to believe that's a unique situation, that the popular mobile antennas you can buy today, I'd like to believe they're not going to have excessive swing in the breeze. Is that reasonably true, Mel? Back to you, Mel.
I'll tell you, if you look at those screwdriver antennas, that most likely would have as much wind resistance as my Neutronics. The only thing I think it's a little shorter. The Neutronics antenna, I think is about 8 feet, 8.5 feet, with say a 20-meter loading coil on. It's a little, of course, it's taller with, as you start putting 40-80-meter coil on it, it'll be much taller, but approximately around 8.5-9 feet. I think the other antennas may be a little shorter, but they are more, the diameter of the antenna, because of the coil, may present the same amount of wind resistance on a mobile deck, over.
Okay. When you're changing the loading coil, that changes the resonant frequency. Is there anything else that you also change that changes the impedance match when you go from brand, when you go from band A to band B to band C? Over to you, Mel.
Use it on all the bands, actually, from 10 through 80 meters. And when I change that coil, unscrew it and put the other one on, of course, I adjusted all of the coils up. You know, the coils are adjustable. You get full coverage, no problem, of the 10-meter band, the 15-meter band, full coverage of the band without any problem. 20 meters, you get about 200 kilohertz. Coverage on 20, 40 meters again, as now it starts to squeeze down, you'll get about maybe about 125 kilohertz. 80 meters is really squeezed down to about possibly about 50, maybe even a little less than that as bandwidth, Dick. So it does get somewhat critical. In other words, I have to set it for basically, especially on 80 meters, for the portion of the band you're going to operate. If you're going to operate the sideband or you're going to go down CW band portion, you would have to readjust the antenna. It is capable of resonating in any part of the band. You just got to loosen the screw on the top and adjust the rod that pulls in and out of the top section, over.
Okay, I think I understand that. The particular mobile radio you use, is it one that is no tune and it's very tolerant of a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio? And I think you're telling me that the antenna throughout most of those bands is giving you numbers like around 1.5 and therefore the radio never complains, or are you using an older radio that can tolerate much higher standing wave ratio? Back to you on that one, Mel. Go ahead.
This is K2KEY, the original radio I had in there. Well, we're going to go back now. The original radio in there was all tubes. And I had a 200-watt transceiver in there, a tube job. That'll be back about 1960s. I'm trying to remember now. I took this thing. I mean, remember the original radio. I had an NCX3 in there. What did I have before that? I've had several radios in Mobile In this mobile, I have now a 718, ICOM 718, which is a fairly, you know, new radio, auto, everything auto, you know, no adjusting of tuning plate and loading and all that. On the previous radios, I've had that. In fact, I did have a kilowatt rig in that mobile one time. And so now I'm just running, I just run a 100-watt transceiver deck over.
Okay, ICOM 718, is that the one you're talking about, the 100-watt transceiver?
IC 718, basic HF receiver, transceiver. Very simple to operate, nice big display, and so that's why I purposely bought that radio specifically. Because it doesn't go anything other than at 160 through 10 meters. It's very easy to use. It's got a nice big display on it, so you can, if you have to glance down on it, you can quickly, you know, see what frequency you're on and all that kind of stuff. And doesn't require, you know, intense concentration to do anything on it. It's a bare bones radio. Works. It's very underrated and very cheap as radios go today, but works well. I shouldn't say initially it was as good a working radio until I did work on the receiver. I did, the transmitter was great, but the receiver was a little lacking, and for that price I figured you're not going to get a top-notch receiver that I really had to get in there and do some real serious work on it over.
I understand. Sounds like you got a pretty good combination. And sounds like that Hustler has been there for a long time, like 25 years. Neutronics Hustler. Maybe you're going to go to at least one more letter, Mel. Go ahead.
Here's one also from young people. The young fellow wants to... He says, I want to build a vertical. You always encourage me to try making antennas. And I'd like to now get a half-wave vertical antenna up there and see what happens. I think it would work much, maybe better than my dipole. The problem is, with aluminum tubing, I want to order aluminum tubing. How do you go about ordering? They sell it, and I see in six-foot sections. That's UPS shippable. Now, what am I actually looking for in aluminum tubing? In other words, what fits into what? How do you put them together in these six-foot sections? Do they have a coupling, or do you buy tubes, pipes to fit one into another? And as far as with buying PVC insulators and things like that, how do you go about figuring out what you need? I guess what he's talking about is when you combine pipes, what pipe fits into what, Dick, over?
Go ahead, Rich.
I recently saw an ad for aluminum tubing. I believe, Mel, you might have seen the same ad. TX Engineering, I believe they're selling, I think that's who it is. They make antennas, verticals. I believe now they're selling aluminum tubing that telescopes. Back to net and to EO.
Roughly how many feet of tubing and roughly how many dollars, if you happen to remember, Rich, go ahead. And you could use a little more rodeo.
I think I have a problem with this rig, Dick. I'm upstairs in the bedroom. I don't remember. I didn't really take a close look, so I can't say. But if he goes through QST, or maybe goes to the website, TX Engineering. If he's in New York, I don't know if this gentleman is coming in and listening on Echolink, but if he's in New York, there's a place, he's been there for years, on Jamaica Avenue, by around Sutton Boulevard, called Hadco Aluminum, H-A-D-C-O, Hadco Aluminum. Picture a lumber yard with all kinds of lumber, but replace it with aluminum. This place is loaded.
I've seen one of those, and they're kind of fun. And the way you pronounced it, I'm not quite sure if you said Tango X-Ray Engineering or Delta X-Ray Engineering. I'm going to guess it was Delta X-Ray Engineering is the ad you're talking about in QST. Is that true?
That's correct, Dick. The DX Engineering, Delta X-Ray.
Yeah, aluminum tubing, you can buy it in lots of different diameters and lots of different wall thicknesses, and certain combinations will telescope together very well. And now the engineering design required to get the right length, the right diameters, the right wall thicknesses, so it has enough strength without being too heavy and not being too expensive. That's a pretty serious engineering job. And depending on how many feet you're going, I would try not to buy 6 foot or 8 foot lengths that are shippable. The tubing itself comes raw at, I think it's either 22 or 24 inch lengths. And to have the minimum number of junctions is going to give you the least amount of problems. There also are Telrex and other brand name of telescoping tubings, stainless steel, I mean galvanized steel tubing, which is telescoped and it's got the locking mechanism built in. To buy one of those that's already made and ready to go is a heck of a lot easier where somebody has done all the design for you. To tell a guy that the bottom should be 2.5 inch diameter and 22 feet long, and the next one should X diameter, wow, that's there's a lot of risk in that, and being too stoochy or too light for his particular application. Lots of variables involved. I would first consult the catalogs of what telescoping tubing, if that's what he wants to do, is already ready to go. The slight disadvantage of the galvanized tubing you can buy is that in 15 or 20 years, it might start to rust. And steel is a little bit heavier than aluminum, but it's a lot cheaper. Throughout much of history, aluminum is pretty expensive when you buy it big enough in diameter and thick enough in wall thickness to really being sturdy. The raw material price tends to be kind of high. So that's not an easy one to answer, is it, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, there's a company at Soros, at DX Engineering. There's another one, a couple of them that are selling. And they advertise, they sell, you know, aluminum tubing, I could say, in six-foot sections because it's shippable by UPS. And what they do is they have one end of the tubing slit, and so that you can telescope in another piece of pipe. Now, he only wants to build a 20-meter vertical. He's going to lay the radials. He says use the radials as guying. He said he can put at least four radials up, and he wants to put a piece of PVC pipe on the bottom, you know, to fit it into as the bottom insulator. It's a fairly straightforward job to put that together. I know it was in the handbook. Basically, if you tell them you start out with 1-inch aluminum pipe, 1-inch outside, it's 1-inch OD. Most of the aluminum pipe they're selling, they sell by OD, outside diameter, OD. So if you get a 1-inch OD, 6-foot section, then you get another piece that I think it's 0.875 OD, fits into it. They have a clamp that, like I say, they slip one end of the tubing. They have a nice clamp, little clamp, gear, or hose clamp, actually, that you can tighten on, and you can adjust it. So what you do is you get a number of these pieces. You don't need that much because you're only going about 16 feet. So three sections. And it'll put together. Now, as far as the PVC pipe, you can get that over at Home Depot or anything. So if you have like a 1-inch bottom, 1-inch bottom will fit into, I think a piece of 1-inch PVC pipe has an ID of, 1-point-something. So in other words, I believe a 1-inch piece of aluminum pipe, I'd say, will easily go into a piece of 1-inch PVC pipe, Dick, over.
If I was building horizontal dipoles on a Yagi, and I'm willing to allow some droop, the diameters you're talking about sound good. But as a pure vertical mast, that's not going to whip around too much in the wind. 1-inch diameter strikes me as small, but maybe that's just me. That's my first gut reaction on that one, Mel. I don't have very much more to add to it. Back to you, and you might want to go to the next letter, KQLIW.
Oh, the commercial verticals, I look at that, basically the pipe. They don't use much. I think the last vertical that we put up, that commercial version of that one that they sell for, you know what they get for these antennas, some of them, you know. You can, there's a number of these versions you can put together with this and make yourself even a multi-band. I know they have a very simple version of this that you can have for 20, 40 meters. This one covers 10, 15, 20 meters. You can, you know, you can put this whole antenna together. It's not even on the $50 bill. If you look at the commercial versions, they sell these things. God almighty, they're in the hundreds of dollars, the vertical antennas, and I don't think aluminum pipe has gone up to that extent. I mean, it's unbelievable what a vertical antenna, and it's basically, you're not going to find anything. I think only one or two of them have, like, start out with the base section. There's, I'd say 10 foot or so of an inch and a half of aluminum thick. Most of them, I think, are around about 1 inch base is approximately a 1 inch base, and then they taper from that going up the line, just like they make the elements of the beams basically the same way, same material thick over.
Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, just to suggest, first of all, on a lot of these verticals, like the high gain 1480Q, they use 1-inch tubing, but they sleeve it inside on the lower section. So where the most stress is, sleeve with a double wall, you know, two lengths of tubing sleeve, one inside the other. But there's something they want to do. He doesn't have a lot of money. I know it used to be cheap. High Gain made a single band antenna, which is what I think he wants. It's called, I believe it's called an 18Z as in Victor. It can be adjusted to any band from 10 to 20 meters. And it, because it doesn't use traps, it's single band. It's not too expensive, at least it never used to be. And he might be better off money-wise with that. Are you familiar with that one, Mel, the 18V by Hygain?
Comment about Hygain.
Let me take it for a second. Yeah, I'm familiar, believe it or not. It's not available, I believe, anymore. And the price of it, the last price of it, I've seen that a couple of times. The price is ridiculous. I'm telling you, the prices on these antennas, beams or verticals and all, have gone up immensely high. I couldn't believe that vertical that down a block that we stuck up there. When I saw the price of that antenna that called the Gap, I didn't see that much materials in there to warrant the thing that was $400, Rich, over.
Yeah, Wesley has a comment. Go ahead, Wesley.
I have made ATM-65 that is 64 feet telescoping aluminum mast. And this one has 11 sections. Overlap with quite enough of pipe inside one of the other. And this looks like a very good one for the people they are looking for it. I do not know the price for it, but it looks like a good one. Now, the reason I picked up that is that XE Engineering and that store in Jamaica that sells it. Actually, if somebody take a good look of that high-gain product, they can make it by themselves. And that will be out of check. Back to you guys and to Adrian.
Yeah, the quick question I've got for you, Rich, and to EO, the antenna you are suggesting, was it the half-wave type? The letter writer to Mel specifically wants half-wave type, so he doesn't require a zillion ground plane radials. Back to you, Rich.
Hey, Jake. Well, Mel said he was going to put four radios on it. No, it's a quarter wave, the 18V.
Okay. And the quarter wave, the only four radials on a quarter wave antenna, gives you mediocre performance, but you're still covering quite a bit of RF energy into the ground. Mel and I are telling people that if you have the real estate to put up half wave, no matter how you resonate it, even if it's going to be narrow band because it's got a big loading coil and you're not making it full length, still half wave has got a lot of performance advantage, and it's a underused antenna in my opinion. We've only got a minute and a half left, Mel. Back to you, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, yeah, well, he wants to put it up and try, you know, make something like that up, and he wants to put four radials on it, and, well, let him try it, and he can always add radials to it. He said, can I start out with four, and I said, definitely can start out with four. I'm just looking here, just quickly, through a catalog here, just to give you an idea. A simple dipole for 20 meters, this is all they are supplying you is with three insulators and a little Balaam matching network where you also, you know, center point for also tying the coax to it, is $40, Dick. That's for 36 feet of wire, and this little couple insulators, and like I say, a center point is $40 just for a piece of wire now. Can you imagine that? Over.
Oh, yes, I can. And you and I are used to the older prices, and inflation is always there, and it's not easy to adapt to inflation. This was TechNet number 1,271 of the series that began in September of 1982. Mel and I will probably be back next week as long as we stay healthy. 73 you all, be kind to each other, and bye-bye for now. Back to you, Mel. K2RIW clear.
Roger, roger. I just say we'll try to do it again. I'm just looking at the prices here. A phenomenon. The broadband folded dipole repeater for, for 20 through, 10 through 20 meters, $289 for a broadband folded dipole that really, you can easily make this thing up with some insulated plexiglass pieces of spaces and all that stuff. And can you imagine with shipping and all, $300? So the prices today, they're outrageous, let's face it. For this hobby became a rich man's business, to tell you the truth. It used to be the poor man's hobby. Okay, 73 is all, 12 o'clock. We'll see you all next week. Take care, and we'll try to do our best with this. Take care, Dick. See you, too.
Hey, Gracie.
Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Good night, guys. N2RDB.
Disconnected. Reflector 9126. Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
The time is 12:10 a.m. This is the WQVL repeater. WQVL repeater system. The time is 12:17 a.m. The time time is 12:27 a.m. Good morning. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.